What's up, fools? Welcome to the seventh circle of hell, also known as our economy and monetary policy in this country. By the way, this is the QTR podcast. How are you? Today is April 9th, 2020. What a day to be alive, folks. What a time to be alive. All hell is breaking loose, and we have Carson Block here to help make sense of it. Before we get started, I want to remind everybody that this podcast, like all my podcasts, is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. Lots of people bitch and moan because I talk about my patrons at the beginning of every podcast. Goes like this, fools. Put your listening ears on. You can skip past it on a YouTube video, so don't worry about it. And you can skip past it on Podbean or anywhere else you're listening to the fucking podcast. You don't have to, and I never interrupt podcasts in the middle of the podcast. I hate when people do that. So I always give the interviews unedited. You got to deal with 5, 6, 7 minutes of me telling you about the people that make it possible to begin with. So let's do that. First and foremost, my friends over at the Sang Lucci Steam Room. What do they do with the Sang Lucci Steam Room? My homeboy, Sang Lucci, Anand Sanghvi to his friends, by the way, runs the Steam Room, which is a live online platform all day that tracks money moving into the options market. Money moving into the options market is coveted information because oftentimes it can telegraph where certain stocks are going to wind up going. Because the options market is so much more illiquid than the equities market. It's an awesome tool if you are a trader. I've known Lucci for probably 100 years. He's one of the smartest people I know. He's an honest guy. I'm going to be speaking with him, I think, on the April 11th Traders for a Cause event. Just an all-around good dude and an honest person, providing a product that makes sense, it works, it's aesthetically pleasing to look at, and hopefully will help you make some money. So check out my homeboy Sang Lucci over at the Steam Room. He's also offering the 3LT playbook, which are the three simple rules he used to make himself a million-dollar trader. I've seen the accounts. It's not a bullshit line. He's actually worth that. And he offers the Sang Lucci Master Course, which is investor education for people that don't want to listen to financial jargon and bullshit. Sang Lucci and Charlie Bathgate, what's up, brothers? Check them out. The links are in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my very good friend, Pete Hegedus, over at The Trader's Path. Pete was a member of a bunch of bullshit online day trading communities and then figured out that none of them were there to help him. They were only trying to screw him. So he said, I'm going to start my own trading community. And that's exactly what he did. It's called The Trader's Path. He started it just last year. I'm one of his first partners to help him get the word out about it. He has been an ardent supporter of the QTR podcast for a while before he even did this project that he's doing. He's gotten great reviews, a lot of success since he started it. What does he offer? He offers an online community, daily watch lists, live streams, investor education, and just great community to have if you're a day trader. Look, if you're, especially now with things going crazy and all hell breaking loose, it's not bad to have a group of people to bounce ideas off of and to talk to and to just surround yourself with. And when you do that, you don't want to surround yourself with dickheads and assholes like the guys who run the trading services that we all have heard about, who, by the way, have their PR reps email me all the time to try and get them on the podcast, which that is a firm no, unless I get morbidly curious one of these days. But yeah, so Pete said he's going to do his shit a little bit differently. He's an honest guy, and he's a Liverpool supporter. So what's up, Pete? Check out Pete over at The Trader's Path. His link's in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by another great tool if you're a day trader. My friends over at RumorHound.ai. RumorHound is a product like nobody else has. What is it? It is a artificial intelligence-based piece of software that examines potential merger and acquisition rumors as they happen on a daily basis, and it spits back out to you a recommendation of how credible it thinks the rumor is. Now, you know, obviously, if you're a day trader, money can be made and lost with merger and acquisition rumors, and especially if they go through or they don't go through, it can be very lucrative. So these guys wanted to put forth a piece of software that kind of helps guide people in their decision-making on those things, and that's what they did. They don't mess around with anything else. This is what they specialize in, and it is a very unique piece of software. There's nothing like it out there. The service is affordable. They'll give you 14 days for free if you want to try it out, and you make money over 14 days, and it pays for itself. Great. You can check it out then, and if it doesn't and it sucks, then you can email me and tell me I'm an asshole, and that's fine. Check out rumorhound.ai and also follow them at rumorhound on Twitter. And they give you basically free news as merger and acquisition rumors hit the wire. So you're going to get that regardless just by following them on Twitter. Check them out. Links in the podcast description. Tell them the QTR podcast sent you. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Corvus Gold. What's up, guys? Nice to see gold fucking ripping here over the last 3 months as we knew it would. It's a shame that it had to happen from the Fed pouring gasoline on our economic system as we know it and lighting it on fire, but can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs, I guess. This podcast also brought to you by Jay Mintzmyer. We'll also be at the April 11th Traders for a Cause event. My buddy Russ Valenti, my friend Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud, who is running Traders for a Cause on April 11th. They've got like 3,900 fucking people signed up already. I'm going to be interviewing John and Pete Najarian, I think. That's what I'm doing there. It's this Saturday, so I better prepare and do something. I forgot about that. Chris Bede, Ken R., Chris Boas, Crichton Titus, Dylan Davis, what's going on? All my homeboys. Ken, J.K. Cunningham, Stank Love, Brainerd Ferguson, and Matt Merrill, what's going on? And my friends that just checked in on PayPal, I'm sorry I don't have the list of names here, but one of you sent me a nice donation, which I really appreciate, and I just want to let you know that I got it, and it did not go unnoticed, and that's very much appreciated. Appreciate you helping support the cause. Some of my newest patrons, David Harvey, what's up, brother? Terrevoir, or is it Terrevoyer? Doesn't matter. Maybe you're French. We won't hold it against you. Woo! All right, man, that's some strong shit. VJ Sampath, Owen Rigby, Bo Baldwin, what's up, brother? M. Stillwell, Gaz Harkness is back in the house. At Stock Chart Steve, what's going on? Matt Tackett and Hakon Wilhelm Larson, also known as Chilhem, David Svensson, Austin, Edward Chiolo, Duke Matlock, and Mark Dyer, what's going on? And some of my longest patrons that have been with me for a while, Santo P., I still see you, brother. Chris Wagner, Bryce Johnson, Chris Caterhoff, whatever. I appreciate you, whatever your name is. Straight Cash Homie still in the house with Vince Fredrickson and my homeboy CJ Carey still here. Glenn Tung still here. Michael Hahn and the Tesla Q podcast. Justin Bone, Ethan Watkins, and Michael Embley. Why don't we get the goddamn thing started? Two more rules before we do. 2-drink minimum for all my podcasts. Take two to the face. And none of this is financial advice. We are not financial advisors. Well, I don't know. He might be, but I'm definitely not. Point is, don't listen to anything that we say. And that's it. Let's get cracking. All right, I have with me on the line today from Muddy Waters Research and Muddy Waters Capital, Mr. Carson Block. How are you today, Mr. Block?
Well, I mean, look, I think we're, you know, my family and I live in Sonoma. I think we're, you know, we're doing better than most, given that we have some space for the kids to run around. So, yeah, we're, you know, doing okay.
Good, good. Yeah, I saw that you were on CNBC yesterday. And I'm looking forward to getting your off CNBC thoughts. I know the non-Carson Block CNBC.
Right. Yes. Yes. You know, there's a little bit. Got to tone things down for CNBC. That's true.
Or the non-CNBC Carson Block. I'm sorry, I misspoke. But yeah, listen. There's a million things I got to ask you about, man. First and foremost, let's just cover the basics because I haven't talked to you since the whole coronavirus thing has taken place. And how are you doing? How are you handling it? How's your family? How are things as it relates to the coronavirus in general?
Yeah, I mean, we're well situated, and it, like I said, because we live in a somewhat rural area. And it's funny, when we bought this place 3 years ago and we were living in San Fran, bought it as a second home, I did think to myself, you know, and I never mentioned this to my wife at the time. I thought, if there's ever any, you know, real issue, you know, breakdown in, you know, in civil, you know, breakdown in order or society, it's good to have a place like this. And we've been living here full time for a few years because it's beautiful where we are. So it pulled us and San Francisco pushed us. So it's looking like a pretty good trade right now. But yeah, I mean, I'm married to an Asian woman. It really didn't take long for a really fucked up racial incident to occur. The victim was my 2-year-old daughter. So I, you know, I'm really, you know, I think the fallout, the economic fallout of this is, it's just going to be, I mean, you know, devastating doesn't even really, it doesn't do it justice. And I am worried that, having half Asian kids and an Asian wife, you know, could be, I don't know, could invite, you know, some scrutiny or in a nightmare scenario, some violence. So, you know, kind of trying to, I mean, you know, I really, that's a very dark way of looking at it, but you know, you got to prepare for the worst, hope for the best.
Yeah. It's an unfortunate reality is what it is. I mean, you're being a realist and trying to prepare for it. And I'm sorry that those things happened to you. I think I read your tweet about that when you put it up a couple of weeks ago. And, you know,
it was actually 6 weeks ago. I mean, that's the thing. That's how early that was, you know. I mean, that's like, I mean, you want to talk, that's the tip of the iceberg of, you know, how bad this will get. So yeah, sorry to cut you off, but I mean, that to me is the thing that was, I mean, there were a few things about it that were just really, you know, to me, stunning. I mean, number one, that it's a 2-year-old girl. Number two, that it was so early in this. So yeah, it just, you know, hopefully that was a complete anomaly, but you know, we've seen some dark shit happening. I mean, in Midland, Texas, you know, an Asian family, some guy stabbed the 2-year-old, the 6-year-old, and the father. I mean, you know, just people, this sort of situation in which, you know, people who already were kind of, you know, tenuous grasps of reality really lose their fucking minds. So, yeah, so it's, I'm sorry to be so dark, but, you know, this is the reality. I mean,
one of those, you know, you make a good point, right? One of the things that I was worried about back in January, February, once we found out that the virus, you know, once it was examined outside of China and we found out it wasn't, you know, a Ebola, and I was worried about China lying about the fatality rate. Now we kind of have some objective data on that. But the other thing that I was worried about wasn't so much the virus itself, which I was worried about, but the reaction of people and that initial kind of sonic boom of like panic and terror that people were going to fear, or people were going to feel once it became mainstream news here in the US. And it's specifically like that example that you bring up, which is why I was worried, because that is unfortunately how people think. They have a tenuous grasp of reality, like you said.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, it's, you know, I just, yeah. And even as, you know, as really hard economic times set in for people, I mean, that's going to turn to, you know, there's going to be desperation, but there's also, you know, going to be anger. You know, you can picture people lashing out at people who aren't, you know, people who are, you know, reasonably well off, and yeah, people already lashing out at Asians. So, yeah, it's, you know, we're just in uncharted territory here. I mean, I guess the good news, the good news, if we want to, you know, kind of feel a little bit positive about this, is never in our lifetimes has all of humanity had a common enemy and really a common purpose. And that hopefully will count for something and, you know, will make a lot of us really, you know, think differently about how we relate to others. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, look, expect the worst, hope for the best. So that's, you know, that's all any of us can do here.
I hope you're right. I'm optimistic about the fact that everybody in the world is working on the same problem. I think that's a lot of horsepower and it's a tremendous tailwind. And also, I've seen some inspiring things over the last month or two. You know, again, I'm sorry that you had to go through that incident, but I've also seen some shades of people being nice to each other in a way that they weren't before this. And I can only hope that this quarantine and lockdown and, you know, this kind of putting the fear of God into some people, I only hope that we come out of the other end of this more compassionate and with a zest for life that we didn't have before this. You know, are you optimistic that we will, or do you think everything will just go back to the way it was?
Well, yeah, look, I mean, it's, you know, and it became immediately apparent to me after I tweeted that out that, yeah, it's that there is a lot of compassion there. And I don't normally do personal stuff in my tweets, but what was going on there was I'd been away all week. And I was sitting in an airport. I just talked to my wife, And she said, "Oh, listen, by the way, you know, I didn't tell you, you know, I didn't tell you on Wednesday when this happened, but, you know, here's the story." And I hung up and I'm just so devastated. And I'm sitting in this airport, and I'm not with my family, and I'm just, you know, I'm feeling powerless. And so normally, like I said, I don't take my personal stuff to Twitter. I did in that instant, you know, just because it was like a coping mechanism. And yeah, I mean, the beautiful thing was so many people, you know, tweeted back, reached out, you know, expressing their, you know, just saying, "I'm really sorry this happened. That's really inappropriate." And, you know, so my thinking, you know, which I was just in such a state of rage and sadness. It's a strange combination.
Right.
You know, because usually those two don't, I haven't usually experienced those two simultaneously, but that's where I was when I sent that tweet. But then instantly, you know, looking at the reactions, you know, like, but the vast, vast, vast majority of people out there are good people. And this is bringing out, you know, this is bringing out the best in them. So it's one of these situations, you know, like any other highly stressful, you know, I mean, this is, I guess, beyond highly stressful, but, it'll bring out the best and it'll bring out the worst. So the good news is, you know, I think there's a lot more inherent good in people and there will be more best than worst, but you know, the worst will be pretty bad, unfortunately.
Yeah. When you think about the effects on the economy, like you're talking about earlier, I mean, this is really kind of unprecedented what's happening, right? So you have this tremendous, the economy basically grinds to a complete halt here over the last month, and unemployment goes through the roof. And I mean, everywhere I look, like my Facebook feed is just one person after the other. I just got laid off. I'm looking for a job. I'm this, I'm that. I mean, so I think you're right about all that stuff. This, you know, asinine plan here of printing $12 trillion to save the stock market while this is happening under the guise of, hey, we're doing some type of fiscal stimulus. You know, when I said today on Twitter, they could be cutting everybody checks for $40,000 a person, the amount of money that they're printing is, I mean, what do you make of it, man? It's, what do you make of the whole thing from an economic, talk about the economy and talk about our response.
Right. Well, you know, there are two things here that in this case are decoupled. It's the market for assets and the real economy. And last time around 2008, it was the financial markets that were dragging down the real economy. And so, you know, the initial responses to that made sense. I mean, you had to, you know, the big buzzword back then was, you know, risk taking. You had to stimulate risk taking. But what ended up happening, and I know we've all been railing about this for years, is it really was an extension, just an egregious extension of the economic playbook we've been running for the past, you know, roughly 35 years, which is it's a version of trickle down economics that nobody's talked about, you know, where, I mean, the ostensible trickle down economics was, well, if we cut taxes, you know, prosperity will trickle down. But we're really, and that got debated vigorously, but, you know, what really has been happening is, it's like, well, if we stimulate asset prices, that'll trickle down. And, I mean, to an extent, but the problem is we stimulated asset prices so much that it ends up impacting people's destinies in negative ways. So housing is destiny, right? Your proximity to good schools for your kids, how much time you're going to spend in the car commuting versus spending with your family. Housing is destiny. And when we crossed some threshold at which, you know, we had climbed out of the depths of the financial crisis and there was risk taking, but the idea was, hey man, you know, we got to push asset prices higher and higher and higher. And so housing became more expensive. So rents became more expensive. And by the way, every time you go through one of these financial crises or economic crises, I mean, people who have assets in cash come out with assets in cash. And then there are people who, you know, had some assets, but not a lot of cash. And they have to unload these things at distressed prices. And so, you know, cash asset rich people get even more rich on the back end of it. And, you know, we can't keep doing this. I mean, it's not that, you know, capitalism doesn't work. It works. It's just that we've distorted it so much through this focus on more, you know, on stimulating markets and asset prices. So I think, you know, I hope, although there's no sign of that, this wisdom yet in the, you know, in the zeitgeist, but I hope that coming out of this, it's like, okay, you know, once things have recovered somewhat, like, let's come off the gas. Let's not make it our job to ensure that the S&P 500 goes up by double digits every year. Because that will lead to, you know, if we come off the asset stimulus gas, that will lead to some reconvergence in terms of equality in the economy. And also, I mean, let's talk about the fragility, right? So with interest rates so low, you know, all these companies borrowed, bought back shares. I mean, it's, you know, it so pisses me off, you know, when you hear them, you know, whining for bailouts. Oh, how could we have known, you know? But I mean, guys like you, I mean, you know, there are enough of us who've been saying for years this is lunacy and that it's creating fragility. You know, well, I mean, who would have known about the risk of a pandemic? Well, you know about risks, like,
right, you know, risk in general, right?
Yeah, you don't know what's going to materialize, but you don't make stuff fragile. So capitalism really has been warped, and that's the problem. And coming out of this, the politics are going to be, I mean, it's going to be really interesting. I don't have a way to call it, but, you know, you could see that a lot more people would say, wow, you know, this is so fucked up. You know, we need the AOC vision of society, which I hope doesn't happen. I don't think the answer is rejection of capitalism, but, you know, so many bad things were going on here. And I mean, you look at the healthcare system, and a doctor said this to me the other day. So I'm, you know, but he said that he thinks some of the first heads put on stakes coming out of this will be hospital CEOs, you know, because, I mean, obviously, there's been all this debate about healthcare for decades, right? And, you know, it's like, well, you know, we pay the highest prices in the world. Oh, yeah, but, you know, we have the best healthcare in the world. Well, you know, but the outcomes aren't really better than, you know, we have the best healthcare in the world. All those Canadians come here for healthcare. Okay, great. So you're able to give everybody, you know, an MRI fucking like 8 times a day in America. You do not have basic protective equipment for your doctors and nurses, you know, worthless fuck. So I don't, you know, I'm not saying Medicare for all. I'm definitely not saying that. But, you know, this private, I mean, this healthcare system is decrepit. I mean, you know, and so I think the first focus really has to be on improving this. And hopefully it just doesn't turn into another thing that we, you know, massively screw up because of our political dysfunction, which, you know, look, I don't see politics getting more functional, you know, anytime soon. But yeah, I mean, this is also going to be a big deal. So there are a lot of variables here. I mean, economic policy, fiscal policy, you know, and when I say economic, I kind of mean, you know, I'm thinking more monetary, healthcare. I mean, God, you know, it's, yeah.
What are the odds? What do you think the odds are that when we come out of this, we realize that we need to, you know, revert back to the mean a little bit in terms of taking the foot off the gas of asset prices? Because we sure as fuck didn't do that after 2008.
Well, I mean, look, the federal, you know, the Federal Reserve is independent. I mean, although, you know, Trump's kind of.
I mean, do you actually believe that?
No, I think. Well, look, there are degrees of independence in a way, right? I mean, so the thing is, and I'm not anti-expert. I mean, I've had a big problem with populism. The way I've termed it is, you know, it's like, hey, you know, we're on an airplane here. Hey, drunk guy in 22B, why don't you come up and fly the plane? You know, there's nothing to it. Just fucking point the nose in the direction and it goes. I'm not against experts or expertise, but, you know, I think there's a, you know, clearly what the financial crisis showed us was there's this massive parochialism among the experts who actually go into policymaking. And that's the problem. You don't have real diversity of thought. But on, especially because so many, I think that's one of the issues. So in terms of independence, I think the Fed has largely operated independently, but then Trump came in and he's just such a, bully, right? And, you know, I mean, you know, people at the Fed are not, you know, they don't know how to stand up to bullies. I think this is the least independent Fed, at least going into this crisis that we've had in, you know, in for a number of administrations. I mean, Lyndon Johnson apparently was pretty good at bullying the Fed also. Volcker was supposedly nobody's patsy. I mean, a really tall dude. Like, you know, I mean, Lyndon Johnson he was a very tall, big guy himself, got right in the face of the then chairman of the Fed and started jabbing his finger into his chest, demanding that he cut rates. And, that's effectively what Trump has done. So I don't know. I mean, I think they're, you know, going into this crisis, I was saying, well, now that, you know, Trump has set this precedent, I don't think, you know, even if Bernie Sanders, well, maybe everybody except for Bernie Sanders, but even if Elizabeth Warren had won the nomination, won the presidency, you know, I felt before this crisis, she could never say, well, you know, we want a chairperson of the Federal Reserve who's going to be a lot more hawkish on rates and really is worried about out of control asset prices. I don't think that would have been politically possible after Trump made, you know, one of the central functions of the presidency, constant demands to keep rates low. But, coming out of this, who knows? I mean, but, it's like you look at, I mean, certainly with the Trump presidency, if he's reelected, you know, there's going to be no interest at all in finding somebody who's going to be more prudent or finding governors who are going to be more prudent about monetary policy. I mean, Joe Biden, you know, if you vote for Joe, you're just voting for a placeholder until, you know, like the Democratic Party either, you know, is replaced by something else or, you know, can find a, you know, halfway competent, you know, fucking person to, you know, run for office. So I don't know. I mean, just when you look at the political realities there, I'm not, you know, I don't know that Biden would have any. I don't think that this is what he'd really be looking to tackle. And to be fair, I mean, if I were, you know, elected president in 2020, probably not the first thing I'd look at is the Fed, because, you know, you know you're going to need massive stimulus for a while. And you got to really focus on the healthcare system. So I don't know, man.
Do you think we're going to have another, you know, Volcker-esque Fed chair at some point? Do you think that'll happen? Or do you think things are forever changed? Or do you think that change, like a guy like Peter Schiff would say, we're going to be forced to have another Volcker at some point?
Well, I mean, look, we're going to have, you know, we're obviously going to have QE for quite some time. But, you know, if you're dealing with a deflationary environment, that's not necessarily a huge, well, I mean, that's how the government's going to have to finance itself. Now, in terms of the Fed being in the private market, I mean, we've crossed the Rubicon here. You know, I know you've been, you are also, you know, tweeting about the Fed buying stocks, and that could be a concern. There's no legal authority at this point to do that. We had lawyers look into that back in February, and, you know, there's no legal authority. But
does that really matter?
Look, Congress could come together and, you know, pass a new law. But, I mean, in any event, I think, you know, the future of monetary
policy. They're buying junk bond ETFs right now.
Yeah, no, fair enough. The future of monetary policy, I think, is, you know, in the near term is very predictable. As much stimulus as possible, keep credit markets functioning. It's really, you know, once we get past the crisis, and look, we might not have, if there's going to be a vaccine, and I think that's a, you know, that's an if from what I read, because we don't know about whether there's persistent immunity here. And it could even be worse than that, where, you know, they've seen with some, I forget, I think it's dengue. If you're infected with one strain of dengue, you're immune to the same strain for life. But I think there are four strains. But if you are infected by one of the three other strains, then your immune system has a much worse reaction. And, cytokine storm. So there might not be a vaccine. But if there is, it's probably about 2 years. And so, you know, you think, all right, so for the next 2 years, there's going to be massive stimulus. It's a vaccine. People are inoculated. Probably then another couple of years of massive stimulus while the economy kind of returns to normal footing. So it's probably not until 2024, 2025 that you can really start asking this question about, well, where should monetary policy be going now? And, you know, who's going to be president? And are there going to be academics out there who want, you know, who are credible, you know, candidates for, you know, governorships saying, yeah, you know, we really fucked up last time. We can't be so stimulative. I don't think anybody can really call this until, you know, we're getting close to 2024. And I mean, the politics between then and now are, just impossible to predict.
What are the consequences of what we're doing? So you're saying we're going to have economic stimulus to 2024. What are the consequences of that?
Well, I believe we're going to, I believe we need that at this point. I mean, the good thing is it seems like there are curbs on some of the excesses, at least in the corporate markets, you know, going forward. But, there are, of course, consequences to no bad decision going unpunished. But that's been the case, you know, since the last financial crisis. I don't know, man. I mean, you know, this, if you keep this, you know, if you keep doing this again, it leads to further inequality. At some point, we need the stimulus to get people back on their feet. But then at some point when people are kind of back on their feet and there's some traction, you are just creating this, you know, you're further bifurcating society, because we're going to come through this with an even greater bifurcation between the haves and the have nots. We also have to look at taxes. I mean, on the state level, the state budgets are just going to be, this is going to be incredible on the state level. And so I'm really sorry. That's my daughter. Okay, I need to leave.
She can hop on if she wants.
All right. So I think she was just saying something about a bubble. So, you know, that's maybe a very pertinent comment. But as a California resident, we pay the highest taxes in the nation. Top marginal rate is 14.1%. And so on a combined basis, you know, if you're a high earner, you pay a little more than 50% of your income in taxes to the government. I'm not sure just as a matter of principle, like, look, man, I don't want to work and give, you know, I don't want to work for less than half a dollar. I'm okay working for half a dollar. You know, I'm not like a tax evangelist, but, you know, half is mine, half, you know, is the government's, whatever. That's fine. But I don't see how states are going to be able to keep us, you know, states like New York and California are going to be able to stay at that 50% threshold. On the federal level, I think there's some tax changes that really make sense that I'd like to see implemented. To me, this idea of, of a really high estate tax exemption does not make sense. I mean, you're dead, or if you're, you know, if in the last moments of your life you're sitting there thinking like, God damn it, I really wish I could pass more money on, you know what, fuck you. I don't know. And, you know, I have an attitude towards, you know, money, my kids, gonna leave them, you know, they're really young, so who knows, maybe I'll feel differently later, but I'm gonna leave them some. But, you know, like, I want them to work for this. Like, I don't believe in the, you know, I mean, the Lucky Sperm Club exists. It'll exist for my kids, I'm sure. But I don't want it to be, you know, I don't want it to be the major, I don't want it to be a free, gold-plated meal ticket their whole lives. So I think at the federal level, you know, we need to get rid of some of these, you know, really, in my view, indefensible tax breaks, but state level, I just don't see for, you know, states like California, New York, where there's any headroom here to raise revenue. So
what about what the Fed announced that they're doing recently here with essentially buying junk bonds? I mean, you say we need stimulus a couple minutes ago, right? You said, well, we need that right now. You know, do you consider the consequences of something like that, of the Fed going into the market and buying junk bonds, and what that tells, you know, private equity, what that tells the average investor about risk?
No, look, right now, so first of all, things are happening so quickly that there's really, very little data with which to make decisions. So I think, you know, the first thing that we need to do is we need to accept that with the pace of events and the need to do something, because, you know, it's clear there are millions of Americans who are in the process of just losing livelihoods and literally not being able to put food on the table. You know, so we're going to make mistakes, and I don't think I'm going to look back at this point in time and say, you know, and throw a lot of rocks at decisions that were made, at this time. I mean, it's just not possible to make great decisions. Now, I hate the idea of high yield borrowers getting bailed out, but the reality is they do employ people. You know, this is no longer an economy with a 3.5% unemployment rate. You hit the nail on the head. You said, well, we'd be better off giving people cash, but, you know, we're obviously not geared up to do that. I mean, our society, our economy, our government doesn't work that way, where we can just really get cash into people's hands. And, you know, by the way, there would be a lot of non-productive use of that. I mean, I've been talking to a couple of philanthropic organizations locally, because I was looking to try to put $10,000 cash grants into hands of families. And, you know, but then you kind of go down this rabbit hole of like, well, I mean, you know, what if the father's got a gambling addiction, and, you know, or what if, you know, somebody's an alcoholic, and, you know, there's a whole, when you really start thinking along those lines, you know, what if there's, you know, it's probably the single biggest cash infusion any of them have seen, you know, and then what are the tax consequences for them? And so anyway, it's a lot harder. It's a lot easier said than done, but I think in the short term to try to keep employment, that's defensible. But obviously, I mean, when we look at, you know, from a medium to long-term perspective, no, like, we should not be subsidizing interest rates. I mean, that's what the ECB has been doing in Europe. I mean, when you see the ECB buying the bonds of Steinhoff, which then blew up in a massive fraud. I mean, you know, like, that was a great Schadenfreude day for me when I heard that the ECB had owned Steinhoff bonds. I think in medium to long term, it would be a miserable, horrible mistake. But in the short term, if there is evidence or good reason to believe that this will actually support employment, all right, man. I mean, you know, you got, like, we shouldn't have gotten.
What kind of environment does it create when you prioritize the jobs and you say that these people can't lose their jobs, and you use jobs as the justification for bailing out people that are essentially getting paid to take on risk in the high yield market? When you use that line of logic, and then at the end of the day, when the economy grinds to a halt, there's no real demand for their product or services anyways, but the jobs are still there now. I mean, doesn't that just make the problem worse?
Well, look, there are, and of course this is never going to happen, but I mean, there are ways that, you know, when I thought about this, I mean, I hate the idea, you know, I mean, most private equity or the private equity that follows that standard PE playbook of acquire an asset, strip it of value. Yeah, I mean, it's looting the companies, right? I mean, we get that. You know, you lever it up, you make it fragile. These things were, you know, going out of business all the time, even when the economy was strong. I hate the idea of rewarding that. I mean, if there were legislation where, I mean, what they should have done is they should have said, okay, your companies can be bailed out, but you know, at the private equity sponsor level, all your, you know, your bonuses, like in your fees and shit, have to be returned. At least the after tax amounts have to be, you know, returned to the treasury. That would feel really good, but then of course the PE firms would say, well, you know what? Nah, fuck it. I'm keeping my money. Let the company blow up. That's the problem you get. So I don't think now is, I mean, we're going to need real structural reforms eventually, but you know, it's, I mean, Chris, I'm not defending that. I'm not telling you that this is great. I mean, it's the way that I've been framing a lot of these choices that the government has to make right now. It's, you know, it's between horrible and fucking horrible. And honestly, a lot of these choices, it's really hard to tell which one is just merely horrible. I mean, it,
when we got to drink, you know, the fucking horrible cough medicine at some point, every time that we just elect for horrible instead of fucking horrible means that when we are finally faced with it, it's going to be that much worse, right?
Yes, I'm a big believer in the alcohol to hangover, you know, theory, and that the more you keep drinking to stave off the hangover, the bigger the hangover that is inevitable will be.
Now you're talking to my listeners. There you go. Now you're resonating with some of my listeners.
All right, you know, or you know, the more rails you blow, the, you know, I mean, look, but again, this isn't news. I wholly believe that. I've been saying that for, you know, more than two decades. You know, when I mean, going into the first financial crisis, well, in 2002, I went big into gold because coming out of the internet stock collapse, you know, I just saw what the government was doing and I'm like, oh my God, this is insane. You know, we're just reinflating bubbles and this and that. So I went heavy into gold, but you know, that was an okay trade. I mean, it went from, I don't know, this is, you know, long time ago. So it maybe went from like 1,000, you know, and 1,200, 1,500 thereabouts, you know, and then when Bear Stearns failed I had some equities back in by 2008, but when Bear Stearns failed, I dumped all my equities. So that I could save cash to, you know, lose in my self-storage business in China. You know, I mean, look, I'm with you philosophically on this. I just, you know, it infuriates me on so many levels that we've created the conditions where we have to make these choices. But, you know, just the suffering is so real out there, you know, and I just think we need to do whatever we can to address that in the short term, and hopefully this time, this crisis will be the one we come out of it and we say, okay, you know, then let's not throw capitalism out the window. That's not the solution, but let's be really smart about understanding what the government and, you know, specifically central banks have done to distort it. And you know, 'cause I think everybody has forgotten that markets, the whole purpose of capital markets, it's allocate capital, you know, to the best users of it in the economy. And, you know, it's, I mean, in China, it originally, you know, when I first moved to China in the late 90s, the purpose of the stock market was legalized gambling. It was to keep people out of the street, make them think that you could become rich overnight. So that'll ease social tension. And it was also, well, it's another way of, you know, rather than borrowing from state-owned banks and putting China's credit rating further at risk, you know, you go directly to the people and take the money from them for these shitty state-owned enterprises. Like, that's what China's view of capital markets was at the time. And for us, you know, we still kind of had this view that it was to allocate capital efficiently. But now, you know, the capital markets have become the opiate of the people. You know, it's like in the U.S. too. It's like, yeah, you know, just keep pushing things up and, you know, people own ETFs. Everybody's happy. You know, nobody fucking cares, you know. And yeah, we really have to, you know, go back to what is the purpose of capital markets, and, you know, and stop manipulating them, ensure that information is accurate, flows freely, ensure that there is personal accountability for bad decisions, you know, and corrupt behavior. But we were a long way away from that even in January of this year. So let's see where we come out.
Definitely personal accountability. If you're a retail investor at home and you put your money into a stock and it goes to zero, I mean, you're accountable. But if you're the CEO of Apollo and, you know, you're laden with all kinds of leveraged loans or terrible, ugly junk debt, there doesn't seem to be any consequences. There doesn't seem to be any backlash because you're the first one to get bailed out.
Well, look, I mean, I do think you're being a little unfair. I mean, I don't think he's going to see a $50 million bonus this year, Chris.
The CEO of Apollo?
Yeah, I don't think Leon.
Yeah, but to what you just said moments ago, his bonuses the last couple years were predicated on doing exactly what you said, right? Which is
sorry, my sarcasm didn't come through.
Oh, it didn't. Okay,
of course that's not suffering. Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, you're right. It just, you know, look, the thing is, crises are the worst times to try to make these decisions. And fortunately, everybody, this crisis is moving so fast. So I think the good thing is right now that nobody's really, you know, trying to change, you know, the framework here, because if we did, I mean, you know, we probably would end up with Medicare for all as a serious proposal, you know, at this point. So crisis is not the best time to, you know, to make these decisions. We need to just stop the bleeding and really, you know, focus on getting his fucking vaccine or cure or something. But I think that, you know, at some point, once the dust is settling, you know, like, we need to make sure that more rational points of view or other points of view are heard and are accepted in policymaking circles, you know, where it's not just the traditional, you know, jerk offs who run central banks, you know, and come out of academia, and, you know, by the same token, it shouldn't be
and
Peter
appear
Navarro
on the either. Financial news networks.
Yeah, so that's you know, that, but there's a time for that, and that time, you know, is not now. We have to live with the really shit decisions that we've made as a society that you knew were shit for all these years, and I knew were shit. We just have to live with that right now, and it sucks, but that's
when you talk about the role that politicians are going to have in the politics of what's going to happen here. I mean, right now, you know, there's not a whole lot of jostling over this fiscal stimulus because both parties know that it's in their interest to get it done in order to A, make it look like they're doing something, and B, try to, you know, get some relief to people so that they don't just burn down Washington. But coming out of this, Carson, you know, you were talking a second ago, like, oh, capitalism might get the blame here, which really is kind of ridiculous when you think about it, because capitalism didn't have anything to do with the virus coming about. It may have something to do with how we're responding to it. But do you think the fact that politicians in general don't seem to have a fucking clue how the capital markets or finance works? I mean, all you got to do is watch one of these congressional hearings where they try to you know, question the heads of banks and question the head of the Federal Reserve. I mean, nobody on Congress understands economics. Nobody on Congress understands finance. You think that's going to work against us as people try to stake their political claim here and make their political points and agendas coming out of this crisis?
Well, yeah, but look, if you can boil, so when I was in elementary school and I got to fourth grade, I was able to run for senior roles in student council. So I made a couple of runs for president of student council, and I thought I was the most competent person up there. I got up, gave great speech. This is what I want to do. You know, I want to make sure that the fucking lunches are good, and, you know, we've got fully inflated kickballs, whatever it was. Like, I was a substantive guy. And then, you know, this other guy got up there, and, you know, he was a friend of mine, but he was like the coolest guy in the school, right? And he was an athlete, and he just got up there, I think it was Steve Paxton, he's just like, hey, everybody, hey, vote for me. And he sat back down, and everybody's like, yeah, you know, what do you learn about who gets elected? Okay, getting elected is not usually about substance. It's politics are about their popularity contests for the most part. And we, you know, we've as a society, I mean, as creatures, we don't usually put forth the people who are the most competent. We put forth the people we like the best. I mean, how many times have you talked politics with somebody and just like, oh, I'd really, you know, that's a guy I'd like to have a beer with, you know, so he should run the fucking world. So let's not expect these people to be experts on anything other than getting elected. I mean, if I could boil down the job of a politician into one sentence, that job is to be elected or reelected once you are elected. But that's the calculus, right? I mean, it's a shitty job, man. And I mean, so at the end of the day, as a society, we need to look ourselves in the mirror and say, we do this. You know, we want these people to come out here, kiss babies, tell us that we're so funny, eat the corn dogs at the Iowa State Fair and pretend it's the best corn dog they've ever had. You know, we're not saying, listen, I want you to tell me, you know, in ways that don't make for good sound bites, but, you know, I want to read your policy paper on this, you know, XYZ. And, you know, and we're not saying, no, that's too simplistic, man. That's full of sound bites. No, you know, how do you actually, I mean, we don't have the appetite for that. And I, you know, if this doesn't give us the appetite for that, then nothing will. But, you know, so politicians are going to be focused on getting elected. I think in crises like these, they lose their religions and they're willing to, you know, and this, if there's ever any moment in which they're willing to be selfless and do the right thing, it's crises. It's not after the crisis, though. But, you know, we just have to make sure that, you know, other voices are getting through. And, you know, I mean, there are some people of good conscience, you know, in politics, but most of them are just partisans now. And unfortunately, you know, those parties, I mean, their ideologies are so rigid. So if it's Republican controlled Congress and presidency, you know, you have to go in there and you have to package these proposals, you know, in the way that's going to, you know, that kind of jibes with their ideology. And, you know, under Trumpism, you know, the market needs to go up. So nobody's going to listen to us if we go into DC and say, look, the market doesn't need to always go up. You know, the market needs to discriminate between winners and losers. So I don't know, man. And it's hard to blame us because there are 300 some odd million of us. But you know, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, if you live in California, all of these fiscal measures are on the ballot every single election, you know, issue bonds to do this, and nobody ever stops and says, well, you know, what's the running tally here? You know, I mean, nobody knows what the state's debt picture is, or, you know, or what the current fiscal deficit is when they go in and vote for the stuff. You know, we're just not informed. We're not engaged. We, you know,
correct. Well, since the last time that you were on, I mean, now we know that Joe Biden's going to be the Democratic nominee. So what's your prediction going into November, and do you think things would be different, you know, at all if the Democrats had wound up with somebody that was not Joe Biden?
Man, I mean, you know, look, I hate to, you know, and I'm not making a joke here. I hate to say this, but, you know, I do worry if Joe Biden will be alive in November. I mean, you know, you've got this virus going around, and the big problem and thing that I haven't shown my, you know, I haven't really laid my politics out publicly before, you know, because, I mean, look, there, you know, the Trump administration was, you know, directionally correct about China. And what I give him credit for is moving the needle, even though at the end of the day, Trump, you know, backed down from things that he should have done. You know, that Hillary Clinton would not have been even close to, you know, the point where Trump was, though. But, you know, this is public health. And I think part of what's happening, no, Trump did not cause the virus, but the extent to which it got hold in the U.S., the extent to which it continues to in certain states, because they, you know, they take their cues from, you know, beloved leader, it's just really problematic. We need a new administration. I think almost anybody could be doing a better job of protecting public safety and health than the current president. So with that, I want somebody else to win. I worry about Joe Biden not being alive at that time, you know, especially because of this virus. But, you know, to me, the frustrating thing is, nominate a fucking vice president already, because let's say he is incapacitated. Okay, who has legitimacy as a Democratic candidate now, you can't even really hold primaries. You're not going to have a convention. Who has legitimacy to replace him? What, right. the guy who just dropped out, Bernie Sanders, when it was clear the majority of Democrats did not want him? No, he's not legitimate. Like Kamala Harris? I mean, why would she be legitimate? Hillary Clinton, because she was the last nominee? Of course that'd be horrible. I mean, who do you go to? There is absolutely no bench here. And that's the thing that really bothers me, is I think nominate, you know, a young female vice president. I mean, he said female already, so it's got to be female, but they're also less susceptible to this thing. Nominate somebody who, you know, good. And, you know, at least that way, if Biden's incapacitated, there's at least a real candidate there. But I mean, this, I think, is the second biggest threat to our democracy right now. The biggest threat being that we're not able to do elections or to do real elections in November. But the second biggest being that there's no legitimate Democratic candidate.
Yeah, and a lot of people are thinking about it the exact same way that you are, right? Which is specifically why I asked this question this way. In essence, there's going to be a lot of people out there that aren't even going to be voting for Biden. They're going to be voting for his potential VP pick, because if he makes it to November, then it's a question of whether or not he makes it through 4 years. And if he picks a complete moron as his vice president, or somebody that I don't agree with, let's say he picks AOC as his vice presidential candidate, right, which I don't think is going to happen, but let's just say that. I mean, that puts us in a, or, you know, Kamala Harris, who I disagree with and dislike for a different set of reasons, but just also really don't like at all. That's a frightening idea. The fact that, you know, there is a, I don't know, man, to me, it feels like, and I'm not a doctor and I'm not trying to make any kind of morbid statement here, but to me, it feels like there's a more than 50% chance that Biden wouldn't be able to finish a 4-year term. I mean, it just, I don't know. I mean, it's just the impression I get. I'm obviously not alone if you're saying the same thing, and I know other people have. So his VP pick is so crucial. I mean, who would you recommend as a VP for him? If you were lead strategist for the DNC, what does an ideal candidate look like to you? And what does a non-ideal candidate look like to you?
Well, again, go back to the comments on, you know, who do we vote for? You know, we you know, these are popularity contests. Who do we need? We need Mike Bloomberg.
I mean,
in a way, you know, it would have been, you know, it would have been really interesting if this crisis, you know, had hit us just a few months earlier, because I think all of that, you know, billionaire bashing, that was just demagoguery, you know, a mirror image of, you know, Trump and Mexicans, you know, just straight up demagoguery without substance, you know. I mean, I think that would have been blunted. And it's like, you know, who do you really want? I mean, we clearly have a massive problem at the federal government level. Right. You know, the federal government is not running air traffic control, or it should actually be taking the lead in purchasing supplies. Instead, they're saying everybody go out there and have a 50 state cage match. Oh, by the way, we're entering it too. So like the federal government, if this was reported by the LA Times the other day, federal government is seizing the supplies from states and hospitals.
Right.
They're just seizing them with no explanation of where they're going. You know, so now it's a 50 state cage match with, you know, the federal government in there being like, you know, just, I mean, the, you know, I don't know, the, like a gorilla, in the 800 pound gorilla. And now it's a 51 party cage match. I mean, we need a functional federal government here. And who is the best manager that, you know, it was remotely in the field? Clearly the best manager would be Mike Bloomberg. Now, Mike, unfortunately, has that same demographic issue that makes Biden susceptible, although he does appear more spry. So, I mean, I think you got to go outside. I mean, who's been a manager? I mean, find a governor. Find a governor who's done a good job.
Howard Schultz has been a manager.
Yeah, he has. I mean, I'm not sure how I feel about that guy. He was a lot less. He struck me as a lot less intelligent than I'd hoped for at the outset of the campaign. I mean, it's not a measure of anything, but I remember how a few weeks into his, you know, I might be a candidate, you know, campaign, he only had like 100,000 Twitter followers. And I'm like, bro, you know, you were CEO of Starbucks? Like, how do you, and you're, you know, you're a billionaire, a serious candidate for office, or you should be. How do you not have any traction on social media, even though you're tweeting all the time? Like, what, you know, what kind of, I don't know, frankly, I mean, look, that's not the only reason. He said some things that were clearly just not, yeah, he didn't strike me as a brilliant guy. You know,
funny thing about Bloomberg is if he just would have been himself on stage at these debates instead of trying to be a politician, like, there were so many cringeworthy moments with Bloomberg that made him a turnoff, I think, to everybody, because he had these little, like, quips and pre-scripted little things that he wanted to say on stage. And, you know, one thing you can say about Trump is, you know, he's, you know, he just says whatever the fuck he wants. And a lot of people don't agree with it. But he's never stopping around thinking about, well, is this the right thing to say or is this not the right thing to say, for better or for worse? And I think if Bloomberg had done that during the debates, he would have found a little bit more success, because he is a New Yorker. You know, he's a little bit different than Trump. He's cut from a different cloth. But with his business acumen, if he had just stood, you know, with, like, the thing with the women in the non-disclosure agreements, if he had just said, yes, you know, this is what happened and we did that and that's the normal course of business, and then just left it alone or whatever, instead of going back and doubling back on it and, oh, we're going to release them and this and that. If he had just had a little bit more constitution when he was on stage and was himself a little bit more, I think he would have done a hell of a lot better.
Right. Well, the, you know, and I look, I was super frustrated also. That was the only, you know, his first debate was the only debate I had tuned into, because, yeah, I was like hoping to see this guy. You know, he was looked like he was catching fire. I was hoping to see him further that, or at least get through it. You know, Elizabeth Warren's great contribution to the 2016 race was obviously just absolutely sinking him in that debate. But, you know, I heard somebody who was part of his debate prep team speak, and he said, look, Mike was well prepared. Mike was aware that he was going to get attacked. He didn't take this lightly. He said, but, you know, I forget what sports analogy he used, but it's kind of like saying, you know, it'd be analogous to saying, hey, Jose Canseco, you know, why don't you come into a major league game and hit this pitching? Like, you haven't swung at, you know, 95 mile an hour fastballs, you know, thrown by the top players in years. You know, you haven't seen a nasty curveball like they can throw. Like, you know, Bloomberg was out of practice, and he's going against these people who are in, you know, the prime. I mean, they've been doing this for months, you know, and so his whole point was that, you know, it was just you're going against the best in the world right now. And Mike, you know, in the debate, in terms of debating, and Mike, you know, Mike's rusty. I mean, he hasn't done this in some years. I mean, it's and he was never great at it, but he was, you know, competent enough, but he just wasn't able to show that when all of a sudden, you know, he became the guy that everybody wanted out of the race, or everybody who was on that stage at that moment wanted out of the race. It was, you know, it was too much. So, you know, but I think, you know, we need somebody who's like a really good manager. And, you know, you look at Barack Obama, he was not. I mean, he was a great politician, made people, you know, feel inspired. But, I mean, you know, at least I think the idea behind a Joe Biden, you know, should he, you know, and hopefully he does, you know, survive, is he can at least kind of restaff the federal government and stop making things so politicized, and, you know, and hopefully, you know, inspectors general will do, you know, will feel like they can do their jobs and, you know, and things like that. But yeah, I mean, the best person to have would be somebody who has run a very large, I mean, shit, man, spin up Rex Tillerson, get him off the toilet. Like, come right on, Rex, like, you know, you'd be great. So, I don't know.
So, listen, I want to talk about China here as our last kind of order of business. I saved the best for last. I consider you to be an expert in China. Many people in the financial world consider you to be an expert in China. Your report on NQ Mobile was one of the first pieces of U.S. listed China based fraud that I ever read about. I know. You lived in China, you're plugged into what the ethos is there, you're plugged into what's going on way more than the average person. I mean, you're definitely an expert. So I wanted to kind of get your opinion on a couple of things relating to China. I want to open the discussion by asking you what you thought about China's response to the virus, whether or not you thought, you know, and think China is being truthful, and the job that China and the World Health Organization have kind of done together.
Sure. So was China being truthful? No. Was that to be expected? Of course. You know, and back in February when I was talking to my doctor, and she's, you know, trying to reassure me about, you know, the mortality rates, you know, she said, well, look, the data that we have is, you know, your kids will be fine. There are no deaths. And I said, listen, here's the thing. I know China, and I don't have insight as to who really died, but said if there was one group of deaths that they would understate, it would be that of children. I mean, that, you know, because I mean, from a political just firestorm perspective, I mean, that would be, you know, like whatever you want to say about the Chinese, like they love their children too. I mean, they're normal, you know. It's you know, it's, and I don't mean Chinese as an ethnic group, I mean mainland Chinese. You know, and so I was always worried that that death rate was understated. It, you know, there, kids are getting sick now, younger people are getting sick. I'm not sure that that's because there was a huge issue with the data and that in those cohorts that came out of China. You know, I mean, these are questions that'll, you know, we'll have a better sense of the answer for, you know, at some point down the line. But yeah, China was obviously lying about the data. And it's predictable. I mean, China, I've long said that China is a shoot the messenger society. And, you know, it's predictable what these local officials in Wuhan did, which was, you know, they tried to cover it up. And I mean, but that's the culture of the Communist Party. That's a culture that's embedded in communism itself. It's becoming more and more embedded here too. I mean, let's, you know, I do have a problem. You know, again, I'm not, you know, maybe laying my political cards on the table too much, but I have a major problem when I just feel like it's resoundingly hypocritical when, you know, our administration goes and blasts China for trying to cover this up. It's like, you know, man, you know, like 6-8 weeks of bullshit from you and your protectors. I mean, you look at Kelly Loeffner, the senator from Georgia, whose husband runs ICE, you know, and she goes in that January 24th briefing, dumps all this stock and still goes out there and is like, you know, yelling at people that, oh no, this is fine, there's no worry whatsoever, you know, and it's all done to protect this administration. So, you know, we're right now, unfortunately, not above lying and covering up either, but that's what China did. It was a bigger scale. It meant a lot more to the world at that point. But then, look, once, you know, and it's just like every other crisis in China, once they can no longer deny it, the CCP has to change the narrative. And, you know, we're the ones, you know, on the front lines fighting against this. This is the enemy. We're the guardians. But they really did do a lot to, you know, lock down the country and stop the spread. I mean, I think, you know, what I really want to go back to when, you know, when all of this is over is SARS broke out in 2002 in a wet market. Okay. This was a known risk, if not a probability, that we were going to get a coronavirus coming from a wildlife market. So one thing that I would like to see in the new world order is I would like to see trade measures, tariffs and non-tariff barriers employed to enforce public health hygiene policies, as well as possibly some environmental, you know, which is, I mean, nobody ever really talked about doing that before. It's like, well, you know, why should we sign the Paris Accord when, you know, China and India, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, how about we, you know, kind of put a gun to, you know, China and India's heads and say, here's how this is going to be phased in over 10 years. If you do not meaningfully do blah, blah, blah by this point in time, then tariffs are going up. If you don't do this, you know, and you know, if you do this with enough lead time, supply chains can rebalance and everybody can readjust. I would like to see the same thing being done in the aftermath here with respect to not just in China, but, you know, everywhere that, you know, it's kind of like you have wet markets or you have these practices where it's just totally condoned, where wild animals are in close proximity with people. I mean, there have to be, you know, there have to be substantive efforts by the governments to curb these businesses and, you know, and try to prevent this problem from happening again. So that's where I'd like to see trade policy ultimately start to go.
Does it bother you that, you know, one of the things I wrote an article on March 28th about how the whole rest of the world, everybody, and especially here, I see it in the mainstream media in the U.S., CNN, Bloomberg, Fox News, everybody, the whole spectrum, they all still continue to use China's data as though it's gospel. And specifically where I have an issue with it is a couple of things. One is like how we model what the virus is going to do going forward. So people are relying on the Chinese data being accurate. And the second is this idea, like you were talking about, where people are turning around and saying, oh, look at what a shitty job the United States is doing in handling this, because Paul Krugman tweeted out a graph that shows the U.S. number of infections rising far above China's number of infections, and that makes us look worse than them. I mean, does that bother you that data is being relied upon, and do you think that, you know, that's part of their reasoning for it, to kind of shift that blame?
Yeah, I mean, yes, yes, and yes, but you know, we're so used to that. I mean, that goes back to this, you know, this issue that I've had, you know, and I've talked occasionally to economists or, you know, investment professionals. It's like, you know, everybody's like, okay, so, you know, China's GDP number for the past quarter was, hey, but you know, they make it up, right? Yeah. Okay. Why is it relevant? Anyway, China's GDP number, da da da. You know, and then when you get into how investments are made, you know, it's like, because we don't know any. It's like nobody knows any different. You know, I guess it's just this familiar pattern of behavior, but it's you know, massive cognitive dissonance. I mean, you talk to people who are long China equities. You know, and at least in, you know, not talking retail investors, but you know, if you look at the page one investors of Luckin, guys who are, you know, in there buying more even after I tweeted out that that report on Luckin. You know, it's like, yeah, I think they knew Luckin is a fraud. They knew the report was correct. That wasn't the point. It didn't matter. You know, they need to be in China. Why do you need to be in China? Well, because China's growing really fast. Yeah, but you know the numbers on China's growth are all bullshit. Well, yeah, I know they're bullshit. So why do you think China's growing fast? We need to be in China. You know, it's just, it's such a familiar pattern of thinking that pervades, you know, that pervades Western societies when it comes to dealing with China. It's like, we know the numbers are fake, but we care anyway. So, and we're going to pretend for, you know, like we're going to pretend they're real when we, you know, need to make decisions, but we know they're not real. I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, cause I guess the question is that they might ask if they really stop to think about it. Well, you know, like, what's your alternative? Carson, GDP numbers are overstated. What do you want? Like, how should we figure out what the real GDP is? You know, like, yeah, I mean, that would be me saying, I don't know, guys. So
you know, Luckin, so you put out this warning, right? And you've got this track record as somebody that knows China very well, and you're definitely an expert in the U.S. listed China-based company space. I mean, they made a whole fucking movie about stuff that you worked on called The China Hustle. And
right. Well, that was Dan. I mean, Dan was the main guy there. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a group of people that all work to expose U.S. listed China based frauds. And you were a part of that group.
Yep. Yeah. Dan, Soren, Matt, some others. Yeah, definitely.
So even Sam was in there. Sam did some work on China mm-hmm. companies, Citron. So yep. The question is, you know, with when Luckin kind of imploded here, I immediately had this thought, like, oh, maybe this is big enough to kind of get the message to people that Carson knows what he's talking about, or that the people that have been skeptical of this space know what they're talking about, and that these companies really are not what they say that they are. And, you know, maybe people will understand that, you know, the lack of due diligence that goes into these companies before they list and things like that. And then, you know, here we are 2-3 days later, and I'm watching all these Chinese names. I watched Tal come out and expose, you know, another company that you've written about. I watched Tal come out and admit, you know, hey, we're overstating this, that, and the other thing by a couple of percent. And, you know, the stock pretty much goes green on the news, right? It goes down to 40. It comes all the way back up. Today it's, you know, I think it was trading at 53, 54, which is where it was before they even announced that they were doing, right, anything fraudulently. So my question is twofold. First is, why are these companies coming out now and quote-unquote admitting this stuff like Luckin did, like Tal did? I think it's an interesting question. My friend asked me that, and I didn't have an answer. And my second part of that question is, what is it going to take to shake people hard enough to realize that we just shouldn't be fucking with any of these companies without at least doing extraordinarily rigorous due diligence?
Right. Okay. Let me answer the second one first, because, you know, on the China side, or maybe it's a question you didn't quite ask, but it goes back to what I said a couple minutes ago. And that is, you know, the guys who are along this know that these are frauds. They don't care. Okay. The person who wrote that report, is very, very smart guy, you know, only does China. He does China long short. Okay. He knows that these companies are fraud. So, you know, when we were talking months ago about, you know, about something, you know, he said to me, he's like, oh, you know, Carson, you really should write a long report on Tao and on New Oriental. And I said to him, I'm like, bro, you know that we shorted both of those because they're frauds. He said, yes, but, you know, you lost a lot of credibility over here for that. And, you know, I said, well, they are frauds. He said, yes, but they're good companies. Like, they're frauds, but they are good companies. And they are growing. And, you know, so, but this is the same guy who can turn around and write this Luckin report, you know, and, you know, this is, you know, this is a big fraud, blah, blah, blah. And the reason for that is, I mean, he's just very typical of this space. If a company is lying about up to 30% of its revenue in China, you know, in the China space, that's a real company. Like, that's as real as any company will get, is, you know, 70 to 80% top line reality. And that's acceptable. But yeah, you know, if you cross the 50% threshold, well, you know, then it's a problem. So the guys who run China long short, you know, most, you know, guys except for Jim Oberweis Jr., who I don't think is in on the joke, but, you know, everybody else I think is. And this includes basically, you know, all your page one holders of Luckin. You know, the strategy is go long the good frauds, go short the bad frauds. And, you know, what would change that? Well, you know, we can expose frauds all we want, but if nobody thinks there's a risk to holding them, then it actually is like, well, you know, since the financials are bullshit, they're not going to miss numbers. You know, they're going to grow very fast on paper. So it becomes this incredibly surreal risk calculus for the holders, which is, well, you know, yeah, fine. Muddy Waters just tweeted this report out. Yeah, I looked at the report. Yeah, you know, I believe it. Looks like real work went into it. Who's going to do anything about this? Who cares? And I think what happened in this case was the auditor cared. And people misunderstand auditors' roles. I mean, like, literally, they are not there to find fraud. But what ended up happening, and it's an unfortunate, you know, the consequences of this are really unfortunate, but in the first wave of China fraud exposures and delistings in 2000, that began in 2010, got to this point where the SEC was demanding audit working papers from the China affiliates of the Big Four and I think BDO. And those China affiliates were saying, look, there's the state secrets law here. People can go to prison if we provide this information to you, the SEC. We really can't do that. So the SEC then went to the global parents, or at least the U.S. affiliates, and said, okay, we want these papers. And they said, well, you know, we don't have them. That's the local affiliate. So the SEC then sued these affiliates, and an administrative law judge in the SEC court ruled that if they weren't willing to provide the audit working papers in these five or six matters, that the local affiliates would lose their practice, their registration in the U.S., which could have meant, depending on when the audits hit, relative to the deregistration, that a bunch of these companies would have been delisted. And, you know, this is where the Obama administration really didn't understand the leverage that they had with respect to delistings of China companies. Because, you know, it's not like China needs the U.S. capital markets so they can feed these companies so that they can generate economic growth. They don't need that. I mean, that's not what I think really drives the decision making here. Really drives the decision making is that policymakers, through their families, own huge amounts of these, you know, through the families who have proxies, own huge amounts of these companies. You know, it's PS. I suspect a lot of them water their stock all day, you know, in Cayman. But, you know, I think that's the leverage that the government has is like, hey, you know, you think you've got, you know, $3.2 billion worth of holdings of U.S.-listed China companies. How about we just delist these fuckers and your holdings are basically, you know, gone, or if they're, you know, valuable in theory only. That would change. That's real leverage. That would change a lot of behavior. But that never happened. The Obama administration prioritized, you know, whatever else in the China relationship. The threat receded. The SEC has been very frustrated trying to deal with these companies because, you know, just when you think about the amount of resources an investigation consumes, getting all these documents translated from Chinese into English.
Sure, yeah.
And the SEC can't compel the production of many documents. I mean, they can't get SAIC filings unless, you know, like say I provide it to them, because they would have to make a request through the State Department to Chinese Foreign Ministry, which then would go to blah, blah, blah. You know, and they just can't do that. I mean, for these investigations. So, you know, and the other thing is the SEC. I mean, they had all these investigations going, and at the end of the day, no mainland chairman went to prison. Everybody settled for pennies on the dollar, and it was wholly unsatisfying for the SEC. And so I think that when you're a page one holder of Luckin, you know this. You know, you're like, and so going back to the auditor issue, though, so what happened to the auditors was they learned that if we start, you know, if we really start pulling the plug on these China frauds, we're going to be caught between a rock and a hard place, because the U.S. government is going to demand the audit papers. We're not going to be able to comply. And then we're going to get, you know, potentially fucked a lot harder than, you know, the next time. So the auditors really, what they learned was, don't look for fraud. So I don't know what happened with EY here and why they pulled the plug.
It's like the end of Burn After Reading, when the guy's sitting around, he's like, well, what did we learn from all this? And everybody's just like looking at each other like, fuck, I have no idea.
well, it's like the whole, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. Like, right. I guess that's true here, fellas. You know, I mean, if I want to auto-fillate here, maybe the reason why it happened this case was, you know, we just exposed in December a FTSE 100 company listed in London, had a $7 billion U.S. market cap. We exposed that as a fraud. That was NMC Health. It's based in Abu Dhabi. But, you know, so that thing, after our report, unwound really fast. And so they had reported $2.1 billion in debt. But it turns out that the real total is over $6.5 billion, say, all this, you know, illegally concealed debt. And, you know, EY, the auditor there. So EY is getting, you know, EY is just getting absolutely beaten up, or they know they're going to get completely beat up over this. And by the way, they were the auditor in Sinoforce. So maybe, you know, when we tweeted out that Luckin report, maybe, you know, somebody, you know, on the U.S. side or senior partner in China was just like, look,
fucking
guys,
light bulb went off.
like let's be the heroes this time instead of, you know, the assholes left holding the bag. Again, that's maybe me just, you know, performing auto fellatio. But I don't know. I don't know what happened there. You know, with Tal, I mean, my joke was they probably arrested the guy for committing too little fraud. I think the issue was like, you know, he was committing fraud for his own benefit, not the benefit of everybody else. But, you know, Tal, I mean, we wrote the report. It's clear. I mean, Tal claimed to have sold the company and then reacquired it and booked $50 million profit on that. They never even sold the company. I mean, it's obvious. This was a total fraud. Or I'm sorry, Tal is not a total fraud, but that transaction was. You know, but again, if the SEC can't investigate, the directors in China are all in on this stuff, you know. So the problem is our system relies, you know, good faith of directors, which, I mean, even in a U.S.-based company, you know, they have a lot of disincentive not to investigate these things because it's like, hey, if you find fraud, guess what? Years of litigation, you're going to be dealing with your D&O company. Am I covered? It's going to suck for you. Your reputation is, you know, going to be in the dirt. So you don't want to find fraud if you're a director, you know, sitting in the U.S. either. But in China, like, they're all in on it. This is the ecosystem, right? And, you know, since so many of these companies are committing fraud, and that's – and, you know, I have a higher level explanation as to why they do. I mean, I had a self-storage business in China, so it never got big by any means. But what I learned as a lawyer there and doing business there, it is the most competitive, difficult place in the world to do business, because the moment you start making money, all these guys with access to capital who, you know, their whole way of thinking is, I might be in business for only 6 months, but I'm going to knock this guy's business model off. I'm going to underprice him, and I'm just going to take market share. And I'm going to make sure that I recoup my costs in a very short period of time, that I'm going to throw this business away and I'm going to move on to the next business. And that works because the China market is still so price sensitive on, you know, I mean, it's not, I mean, on an individual level, it is not a rich country. So you have that dynamic of extreme competition, but with access to capital. So, you know, it's hard for any business to really remain standing, you know, for long there. Then you have the state-owned enterprises who want to eat your lunch anyway. Then you have all the officials who are up for sale to your competitors, who will put you out of business if you're not, you know, rendering unto a Caesar who can protect you. So it's really hard to actually scale a business that in China and make real profits there. So everything has to be bullshit, basically, in terms of these companies that are selling themselves to outside investors. Now, the manufacturers, a lot of private sector manufacturers were able to do that. But, you know, when you're talking about internet, TMT, companies that are branded, I mean, it's such a difficult business environment that, there aren't many real stories that you could tell public company investors. They're only fairy tales. The economy there does not work like it does here. So that's why you have this ecosystem that brings fraudulent companies to market. Everybody's in on it. You know, all the directors, the banker, you know, the top bankers, the top lawyers, the auditors. This is how they put food on the table. And this is the problem. I mean, there's no solution for us other than to say, you know what, you just can't list here.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it's likely?
I mean, it's obviously not. Probably not top of mind for anybody right now in the government. I mean, like Marco Rubio.
Little Marco, I was just going to say, he's been taking swings at him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he, to his credit, Senator Rubio gets it. There's a small group of people in D.C. who care about it. But, you know, when I've engaged with people in policy circles about China and the capital markets, I mean, they really don't know any of this stuff. And so you go back and go back to kind of what I'm talking about, is communicating with policymakers. So who do policymakers, because, you know, they won popularity contests, who do they lean on for, you know, information about China and the capital markets? Well, they'll go to the investment banks and, you know, go to all these people who have skin in the game on the long side here and on the bull side, and they want to grow their business, and they have no choice but to grow their businesses in China because their competitors are. So they're not going to tell you, they're not going to tell anybody the real problems. I mean, it's a small hand. I mean, it really is probably, you know, just a few dozen people, I think, who are credible in terms of understanding what China does in the capital markets and don't have an interest to, you know, keeping that level, the level of engagement as it is or growing it. It's really a few dozen people, I think. And none of us have really spent the time there in D.C. So, you know, that's something that's on me personally to do, you know, to start trying to provide my point of view. But it's all we can do.
Yeah, okay. I wish you would, man. That would – it would. I think it would help, and I'm glad that you talk as openly about it as you do and share your expertise in it, because I think it's exceptionally important, and we're still, you know, it takes a pretty big megaphone to get through to everybody, so it's good that, you know, you keep pressing on it. My very last question, this is really only a half question, is, you know, given how askew the markets are and what the Fed is doing now and really how, you know, we're flying blind to some degree right now, where's one or two places? Obviously, I know you're not a macro strategist, You know, you're an activist short seller for the most part. Where do you see value right now? I mean,
Oh,
you can
man.
answer sector wide, you can answer with a commodity, you can answer with whatever, you know, like, but where right now is value and how do you deduce that there's value there?
Oh boy, Chris. I'm unfortunately, like, I'm never looking to buy. You know, look, my personal plan, on the, you know, when the dust settles, I think there are going to be a number of legs down in the market. I think that we're still, you know, still people's risk sensors have been so dulled over the past 11 years that I don't think the market has priced in just the carnage in the real economy here. So I don't think it really matters that, you know, that much from an economic perspective that the, you know, that the death rate in New York City is dropping. You know, the carnage is just growing more and more by the day. So I think they're going to continue to be down legs here. At some point, I mean, I'm interested in real assets. You know, I'm going to kind of do what I was saying people with money do on the back end of these. I'm going to buy, you know, I'll buy some real property at distressed prices. I think that'll be, you know, that could be a very interesting trade. You know, I'm not sure about gold. I think initially we're looking at deflation, or, you know, there are going to be a lot of deflationary pressures. The question is whether we're going to, you know, I mean, once at some point, you know, with the massive fiscal and monetary stimulus, whether we will really start to see actual inflation, you know, and the, you know, and this showing up in currency. I don't know. I've been expecting that since 2002. So, yeah, I've been waiting a while. But that, you know, $2 trillion is just basically becoming like a rounding error now. So we've never been in that situation. So perhaps at some point, you know, gold could be, you know, could be, you know, I mean, and, you know, set up for some real appreciation in dollar terms. But I, you know, I think it would be too early for that. So anyway, sorry, I don't have any great stock tips other than, you know, sell eHealth.
No. Yeah, that was it. I just wanted to get your take from a macro perspective. Well, listen, thanks so much for being generous with your time, Carson. I know my listeners appreciate it. I sure as hell appreciate it. And looking forward to, you know, when all this shit blows over, having a drink again in New York City, man.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you, Chris. It's always a lot of fun to do your show. So stay safe and, you know, same to all of your listeners.
All right, buddy. We'll speak soon. Take care. That was the one, the only Carson Block. From Muddy Waters Capital, nobody really knows China quite like Carson does. He is, like I said, one of the first people that I read when I started reading about U.S.-listed China-based fraud. So I thought it was a great time to have him on, talk about all things China-related, virus and the market. I got a couple of good guests lined up for next week. What a big fucking surprise that I say that. Huh? I say it at the end of every podcast, whether it's true or not. Oh, I kill myself. I do. All right, fools. I'm out of here. Everybody have a good long weekend. Stay inside. Drink your booze at home alone by yourself. Trust me, I do it. And check me out. I'm kick-ass. See ya. Peace.